Morning.
Good morning.
Early in my Christian experience, I fell in love with the Gospel of John, and particularly commandments in the Gospel of John, of all things, for somebody one might consider as anti-authoritarian, that I would fall in love with commandments. But the commandments that I fell in love with seemed to have a different flavor of commandments in general. And this particular one has stayed with me all of my life through all of my spiritual transitions, and I think is not just the key to Christianity, but the key to many different religious faiths. And I'm having trouble, I'll share in a minute, let me read this, from the Gospel of John chapter 16, which to me has always been a powerful chapter, chapters 14, 15, and 16 in the Gospel of John, because these are the words that he is speaking to his friends, to his followers, just before he is about to enter into Jerusalem. And more than likely, as the story goes, he's aware of the great possibility that he's going to die. So this could be his last 24 hours on earth. And so here's some of his teaching as he is preparing quite possibly for his own death to what he considers is an important tenet of who he is as a rabbi and as a teacher. "This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no person than this, that a person lay down their lives for their friends. You are my friends if you do what I command you. No longer will I call you servants." And somehow, at that particular point, before his death, he's raising his followers not to be servants or not to be learners, but to be eye to eye with him. They are to be co-equal with him, and that's what he's teaching before his death. "I have called you friends, for all that I have heard from my Father I have made known to you. You did not choose me, but I have chosen you. This is what I command you to do, is that you love one another." We live in, at least in language, we live in a nation that's a Christian nation, as I understand how we would talk about that. But I'm having a little trouble today feeling the love of this Christian nation. And so I wonder, in this Christian nation, when we have this commandment, which is a core tenet of the Christian faith, that we are to love one another, what does that look like? And how are we to love one another? And how are we to do that? The next two sermons are about the duty of peace and peace. And I'm struggling with how to love, as I have internalized that as a value for me, and my sense of duty toward peace. And in my sense of peace as a human being, how am I to love in the context in which I live? And the first thing I'm going to ask you to do is, if we were to look at peace strictly as an inner process of what it means to be human, an inner process as a human in our culture and on this planet, if you were totally dedicated to that value of inner peace, that was your highest value, your I can't say your drive, because in peace you wouldn't have a drive. I don't know if we could say that. But what would your life look like? Would it be the same as you're living now? If peace were your highest value, inner peace, your highest value, what would your life look like? Would it be different? Would it be the same? Take a second and let your mind drift. What would you do this afternoon if inner peace were your primary value? Now let that go. Okay. sorry to disturb you, such a disturbance. Now, what if peace in our society, peace in our culture, peace in our neighborhoods, peace in our government, peace as a value, a high value for our government and our society. What if that sense of peace were your primary value, where your heart and your vision are perpetually working to accomplish and to actualize? And that was what your life was about, pursuing and actualizing not only peace for yourself and for your family, but for your society and your community. How would your life be different? How would it be the same? What would you do this afternoon? And Monday, and Tuesday, and Wednesday? Take a minute. Let your mind drift. Are the visions and what you thought of about your life the same, or are they different? If your life was dedicated to inner peace, is that way of life different if you were dedicated to peace in your culture and society? How many of you was that vision the same? How many of you was that vision different? And I think ultimately this is the tension where we as Unitarian Universalists live. We have religious traditions that move us toward inner peace, Christianity, Buddhism. We also have religious traditions, Christianity, Judaism, and the prophets, to move towards societal peace and justice and equity. And we live in that tension. And how are we about, how can we attend to both at the same time? Today I'm going to present a model, I think that may help both, but I think it also confronts how we live today and some of the primary values in our culture today. And I'm just flat out and bluntly say it. I think we live in a culture today that promotes selfishness, that promotes greed as a value. Now you look at any religious tradition, one of the primary attributes of humanity that is taught against by the founders of that religion and the proponents of that is greed. And yet here we are living in a culture that I think promotes greed as an okay thing to accumulate more and more and more and more. And so it brings us to a sense of narcissism culturally as a value. And narcissism is a perpetual process of bringing how I interpret the world back to myself. That no matter what kind of interaction I have with another human being, and as I'm having that interaction with another human being, I am always in the process of interpreting that interaction about who I am, how that's good for me, how that's not good for me, and are my needs being attended to and taken care of, and how will this person that I'm in dialogue with, how will that affect me? How am I going to go through time? So when I watch television and I see a commercial and the commercial clearly communicates to me that I'm lacking whatever the commercial is advertising, I interpret that I am lacking something, and am I good enough to have that or not good enough to have that, or do I going to have to suffer in my life because I'm not good enough to have it, but I have to live in a culture that tells me it's normal to have it. That's a narcissistic interpretation. Okay. Or as I'm having a conversation, I'm sorry, what?
Okay. I need a better clip.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Or if I'm having a conversation with somebody, or say I'm having a conversation with somebody that I love, and they share to me that this evening they're going to go out and be with friends, and my first interpretation is, what am I going to eat? That's a narcissistic interpretation, right? And I'm not saying that's all bad, because, you know, I have to eat, you know, something. So it could be good. Or if I'm sitting down and I'm watching television, clicking through, and I know that, you know, people around me don't like that, like to stay with continuity of one story as opposed to flicking through all the stories. And as they walk in a room, I go, well, no, I wonder if they're going to sit down and watch TV, and that way I might have to stay with one story. That's about me. That's about me. Or where I go on vacation. Do I really want to negotiate that, or do I want to manipulate it to get to go where I want to go? That's about me. That's narcissistic processing. As I go through life, whatever happens, I loop it around and it comes back to me. And I think that is a primary value in our culture. How does another nation affect the wealth of our nation? And if we don't like it, we're going to do something about it, even if their decision was a democratic process where their leader was democratically elected. How does that affect my gas tank? How does it affect the goods? That's a narcissistic process by the United States of America. See, how does it affect me? How does it work with me? Right? And our country has been known to overthrow other countries because of economic processes and how that affects us. It's just true history. So it is not only a value in our own homes, it's a value in our nation. Now here I am, as trying to be a spiritual person, wrestling with the tension between inner peace, which is one way of life, and peace in society, which is in another way of life, in a society that's pulling me into a narcissistic movement. That's a lot of tension. That's not an easy walk in this life. And I do need to be concerned about myself and my own needs. We are in a culture where in the past two decades, and I think very valid, that 90% of the culture is in a codependent addictive process. We certainly have officials saying we're addicted to oil. We're not addicted to oil. We have an addictive nature, and oil happens to be the substance. So you don't deal with the substance, you deal with the nature. You deal with the inner problem, not with the external. Have you ever been to a recovery meeting? Sometimes the first question is, what was your favorite choice? What was your primary addiction? Because in that community, they know there's a primary addiction, but there's also a secondary addiction, and third addiction, and fourth addiction. And if I can't get my primary, I got another one. I got another one that I use. Okay. So what you will notice in this narcissistic process, or this process where I loop it around and interpret the world about who I am, there's a human capacity that's missing. And that's empathy. There's no room for empathy in that process where I loop it around back to myself. There's no room for empathy for those in another society if I feel like we need their goods in order for us to live as well as we live. There's no room for empathy if this person wants to watch a television show that may be interesting, or that they may need a break, and I'm figuring out how to manipulate them out of the room so I can continue my flipping. There's no concern for the other. That's the difficulty with that narcissistic interpretation. That's the danger, to get concerned in a process where there's no room for the other, no awareness of the other, even though I do have needs that I have to take care of. Even though I am in a codependent culture or an addictive culture, and even though I know that as the stereotypical male, I have the problem of being more intrusive and more manipulative to get my way in this culture, and that for women, there's a tendency to allow that to happen, and that's their addiction. So I got my addiction in women, and it's this gender issue, and the next thing you know, 10 or 20 years have passed, and none of us have really done anything about having our own particular needs met or breaking this addictive process. It's offender, victim, acquiescent, overreaching process that we live in as individuals and as a culture. But yet, I do have my own needs. So how do I bring a balance to that? And this is my suggestion to how we might bring a balance to that. As I engage the world, as I engage the relationships, as I engage in conversations, and in some way, even as I engage my own self looking for my inner peace, that as I see myself moving through time, and I know I'm vulnerable to this narcissistic loop, I know I'm vulnerable to interpreting the world through my eyes and through how I am without an awareness of the other. I know I'm vulnerable to that. So my suggestion is that as I engage the world and I engage others, I become aware of the other person's story. I become aware of who the other person, who they are, their history, what's going on in their life. So that as we engage, I don't loop it back around to myself. I put the conversation in their story. I see them in their entirety. I don't see the other person as an object for use or as an object to make my needs met. I see the other person as another story that's bringing that whole story to engage me, to have a conversation with me. I become aware of the other person and their wants and their needs. And in the awareness of the other person, of their wants, their needs, their pleasure, whatever might be going on in their life, then I make a decision between myself, between them, or I let all decisions go and just enjoy what's happening in the moment. But the important point is that I stop. And I ask what's going on in this relationship or what's going on with this story, and I gather the full meaning of the other, the capacity of the other, awareness of the other person. And then I attend to that. Then I make myself vulnerable to the experience of empathy, to the experience of compassion. And then I allow that value of empathy and compassion to come in my life and help me share, help me choose how I'm going to be, how I'm going to be in this world. But in order for that to happen, in order for the awareness of the other to actually be a primary value in my life, I've got to be able to handle the anxiety of my own self in relationship with the other. I've got to be able to handle the emotional life. And whenever I'm emotionally reactive and I have difficulty handling anxiety, emotional reactivity, I know I'm trapped in that narcissistic loop. How many of you have ever asked yourselves, and after an event and you had an emotional reaction and you asked yourself, what in the world was that about? Where in the world did that come from? How come I'm so angry? What am I doing yelling at the television set? What's going on and I'm emotionally reactive? What that means is I have been kind of trapped into that narcissistic loop. So it's a cue. It's not necessarily a bad thing or a good thing. It's what I do with it. It's a cue. It lets me know that I need to be attentive to myself so I'm not selfish or narcissistic or whatever. It's a problem. So when information comes to us, when an event comes to us, when another person comes to us, or when we engage, I need to be conscious and I need to create a voice in my head to begin to say, what is the story of the other? What am I bumping into? What is this about that's not me? You know, can I get there? I remember one time Helen and I were doing a seminar, and in our seminars, we always do this particular dynamic, and we ask, what was the stage that you were born onto? Because in the stage that you were born onto, there was already a drama going on. And when you got there, people related to you in good ways and not good ways, and that affected the evolution of who you are. And one time, one person could not imagine the world before them. It did not exist. It was too much anxiety, I guess. I'm not exactly sure. But indeed, the world did exist before them. So what do we do with information when it comes to us if we're trying to live a spiritual life that keeps in balance the inner peace and working toward peace in our society? We have this narcissistic loop. We're working toward this nice model, awareness of the others. We can be decent human beings so that when we vote, when we talk, when we speak, we have an awareness of how we affect the other. What do we do with new information when it comes to us? An example of this morning of how what I call being able to contain anxiety works. One time I was with a supervisor when I was doing some of my clinical training, and he said, "Gregory, you seem to be getting hysterical." And I said, "I am hysterical. Nobody's listening." And I was. Now, we didn't pick up on the feminization of my hysteria at that particular point in time, but I guess he was pointing that out. This morning, I got some information that moved me to hysteria, would you say, Helen? And then I didn't know what to do with this information. You know, I love my country. I do. Would I lay down my life for my country? Under certain circumstances, I would. Absolutely true. I'd probably have to be pushed pretty hard because I get that narcissistic loop, you know. So I attend to that. But I would. And people, I grew up pledging the flag. I mean, that's in me. Justice for all, liberty for all. You know, I believe those things. When I look at my faith traditions, when I look at Christianity and I read through there, you know, that gets mixed up in my sense of country. It sure does. You know, because I believe in that faith tradition, we move toward liberty and freedom. The same in Buddhism, and the same in Judaism, and it's there. And you know, and we every week we repeat principles that we want to live in a democratic society, and we want to practice democratic principles within our congregation, within our society at large. So this morning, I know our country's in a financial crisis. But in some ways, I really haven't been affected by that, at least at this point. Right? I'm still doing basically what I've always done. Maybe not drive as much. But I know that our country is at a crisis point. You know, and I have really faith in our leaders, and I struggle sometimes to have faith in our leaders. And I know that when one group of leaders that say I don't agree with are working really hard at propagandizing us, which all do, in such a way, I know the harder they work, that's because there's another group pushing, or they wouldn't have to work so hard. So I think that's valid, because we live in that tension of inner peace, external peace, and how we're going to get there, and our country lives in that tension. And there's a creativity in that tension, and we have to be involved. And so I love being in a country where I can get up here and say the things that I say. And I can go to places where we had a forum, a seminar yesterday talking about clean elections. And we're free to do that. I love that. So our country is in a crisis. And I love my country. And I love the thought of checks and balances and electing people and that we can engage in politics. And I read today, because of the financial crisis, that the proposal from our federal government to the federal government, executive branch to Congress, the initial proposal has these words. Paulson, who is the Secretary of Treasury, he's trying to avert a credit freeze, which, as we've become a credit culture, I am, I mean, we are, if we had a credit freeze, that would be a problem. So I'm for dealing with this, right? He says that he needs to be put in a position of power, and they're going to put this bill through Congress, or try to, and in this bill, it prevents the courts from reviewing any action that he's given the authority to do. Any action. One of the commentators said, in the article said, well, we don't want to slow this process down, and lawsuits would slow this process down. Now, I admit, democracy is messy. We have checks and balances. We try to hear everybody's voice. If you come to one of our meetings where we're trying to vote on something to have a unified voice in our community, you'll see democracy in action. It's messy. We don't always agree, and it is problematic. And the commentator is saying, he's basically saying, trust me, I'm going to do the right thing. Give me absolute control. This is not a monarchy. Well, being a person who likes language and tries to understand language and the dynamics that happen between human beings, the person that first introduces a thought or a word, I know comes from their inner world out there, whether they put, I'm going to do it or I'm not going to do it, they put the word out there, then that means they've been thinking about it. If I say, I'm not going to go fishing, I have had to think about going fishing in order to not to go fishing. So when somebody says, this is not a monarchy, they've been thinking about it being a monarchy. Or you can't say, this is not a monarchy. Our brains just don't work that way. So this plan will raise the ceiling on the national debt. I think it's from $10 trillion to $11 trillion. The Congress is both. Republicans and Democrats are saying, wait a minute, we got to have some checks and balances. The minority leader, Boehner, the Republican leader, is furious. Said lawmakers should ensure taxpayers who give the money, that the money they give and that the taxpayers will be put ahead of the stockholders and the bondholders. Right, so we have this kind of crisis going on. We have a ban on the legal treasury. From one scholar in the legal world said it's distasteful, but we've got to do it. We've got to have action by the Treasury Department that in no way where there's a checks and balance. And he can hire subcontractors. Some are saying this is a dictatorial power. It's unreviewable by the Supreme Court or any court system. So essentially what we have is we have in our financial aspects of our country, somebody saying that I want total control of this because we are in a crisis and I'm going to need to make these decisions as an individual without any kind of checks and balances, and you're to trust me to do that. The same person and group of people that brought us to the crisis, you are to trust me to do that. I will consult with the Federal Reserve Board, which is not a government agency. You're not accountable to anybody in our government. And in the end, they said, the Treasury would take into consideration protecting taxpayers and promoting market stability. That they would consider that. And as many of you have known me through the years, I do get a little hysterical, and I do go out there on the edge and kind of say things that, you know, we agree or disagree, and I'm going, I'm losing my country today. I'm losing my country this week because this is going to be passed by Friday, and they're going to get it to the Congress on Tuesday, this bill. It's only last for 2 years, they say. And then I'm thinking, well, wait a minute. Even after the election, does this position they're going to create supersede the transition? So even after the election, this office is still in power through the next group of people that we put in power. And then the clincher to my hysteria came in. There's permission. You're asking for permission to bail out foreign banks with our taxpayer, with our money. And I'm thinking, what in the world's being created here? I mean, we pride ourselves as a people, whether we like who's running the country, how it's going, and we have a right to fight about that. Are we creating an institution in the process that's beyond our reach as a people? And they're saying, well, we have to do that. So I'm nuts this morning, knowing I've planned this sermon on inner peace. I guess this is the test. If the sermon I'm going to preach is actually withstanding my craziness, because somehow I've got to take what's happening inside of me and contain it in such a way that I can talk about some sense of inner peace. As you can tell, I didn't fully win on that because I'm talking about this, which I just learned about this morning. But nonetheless, I'm working to contain it. I'm working to understand it. I'm having a sense of urgency where sometimes in my life I have a sense of urgency and I've got good people around me that would say, Gregory, I don't think so yet. Slow down on that. And I do, and it's usually a better decision when I do slow down on things and think things through two or three times. But I'm having this sense of urgency, so it's really making it difficult for me to contain it and figure out what to do. How do I respond? So the inner peace is being sacrificed to try to have a sense of peace for our society. And then I'm asking myself, as Unitarian Universalist, as a Unitarian Universalist, and somebody as a Unitarian Universalist who's going to speak to other people, what is the job of a preacher? What is the job of the church? Do I bring this out? I could not have not brought this out, and I worked on my head how to do it, but for who I am, you know, and do we have a responsibility if we every week talk about committing to a democratic process in society to react before it's too late? And then because if it is some kind of at least financial coup, because they're taking financial processes out of the hands of the people, I mean, that's not like somebody running over the hill throwing rocks at you and I'm defending a position where I can throw rocks back. What do you do? What do we do? I don't have that answer at this point. I know it's going on. And then some of you might know, I go think back in history. In 1890, Germany was a liberal, free state. I mean, liberalism was going on. Universities were great. Academics were great. It was just a vibrant society. And 50 years later, it was a horror. And then anytime you look in history, you find stories of free people where their society ends. It's just there. So I know our human capacity is to move through types of governing processes. What is our responsibility as citizens? Can we put who we are as consumers, as investors, as people living comfortably? Can we put that aside? And if I took my responsibility as a citizen and made that who I'm going to be this week, a citizen of a democratic society with this going on, if I were to actualize that citizen in me, what would I do this week? From the citizen's perspective, with this going on in the society where I'm a citizen, what would I do this week, putting aside all the other subpersonalities, bringing out the citizen? What would I do this week? And that's what I'm going to leave you with today, as a citizen, giving this historical context. What are you going to do this week before Congress votes on this bill.